Oppressor of the Jews.
On Sunday, January 16, 1944, just after noon, Franklin Roosevelt received Henry Morgenthau and his aides in the upstairs Oval Room in the White House family quarters. Morgenthau handed the president his indictment of Breckinridge Long and the State Department for gross procrastination and willful attempts to prevent action from being taken to rescue Jews from Hitler. Roosevelt defended his State Department. He said that Long had somewhat soured on the refugees after Rabbi Wise persuaded him to admit a long list of them. Many, he said, turned out to be bad people. Morgenthau retorted that Attorney General Francis Biddle had assured the cabinet that only three Jewish refugees admitted during World War II had been found undesirable. Morgenthau demanded that Long be stripped of responsibility for refugees. He gave Roosevelt a draft executive order to forestall the plan of the Nazis to exterminate all Jews and other minorities. It would create a new war refugee board, including the secretaries of state and treasury, under the president's direct supervision. Roosevelt refused to commit himself. Yet, 6 days later, he agreed to create the War Refugee Board. But he took the precaution of installing his war secretary as a member. He knew that the presence of the sober Henry Stimson, who was skeptical of using military resources to help refugees, would keep the new panel from being too audacious. Why had the president acted? He understood that as the Allies rolled back Nazi tyranny in Europe in 1944, and with more confidence in victory, there might be new opportunities for rescue. He also did not want congressional hearings on his inaction. Roosevelt may also have worried that if so normally uninvolved a Jew as Morgenthau was so upset about the issue, he might be in imminent danger of alienating Jewish voters in big crucial states. If the presidential election were close in 1944, reduced Jewish support could mean Roosevelt's defeat. Delighted by what their boss had done, Morgenthau's aides wrote him a letter applauding the courage and statesmanship with which you and you alone had helped to change this government's attitude toward saving the Jews and other persecuted peoples from extermination. Morgenthau wanted John Paley as director of the board. He knew that having one of his own aides as director would help him to control the enterprise. Roosevelt consented. By the end of the War Refugee Board would help to save perhaps 200,000 Jews in Eastern Europe, France, Italy, North Africa, and elsewhere. Secretary of War Henry Stimson was not happy about the board. He feared it would divert attention from winning the war. He feared it would swell public pressure to send Jewish refugees from Palestine, there to antagonize the Arabs and jeopardize oil supplies. Stimson handed the duty of dealing with the board on a daily basis to his assistant secretary, John McCloy. As Roosevelt took personal responsibility for Jewish refugees, he finally ended his public quietude about what Hitler was doing to the Jews of Europe. In 1944, Hitler installed a Nazi puppet government in Hungary with specific instructions to act against the more than 750,000 Jews there. American Jewish leaders pleaded with Roosevelt and others to remind the new regime in Budapest that for those who harm the Jews, there would be serious punishment once the Allies won the war. That month, under prodding by Morgenthau, Roosevelt made the most direct proclamation of his life about Hitler's final solution. On Friday, March 24, 1944, during an Oval Office session with reporters, Roosevelt spoke for the first time to Americans in plain language about what would later become known as the Holocaust. To ensure that his allies understood that he was not widening war aims, he cleared the statement with Stalin and Churchill in advance. From a script, Roosevelt read out, "In one of the blackest crimes of all history, begun by the Nazis in the day of peace and multiplied by them 100 times in time of war, the wholesale, systematic murder of the Jews of Europe goes on unabated every hour. None who participate in these acts of savagery shall go unpunished," Roosevelt said. "All who knowingly take part, in the deportation of Jews to their death in Poland, or Norwegians and French to their death in Germany, are equally guilty with the executioner himself. Roosevelt went on. He said, "Hitler is committing these crimes against humanity in the name of the German people. I am asking every German and every person everywhere under Nazi domination to show the world by his action that in his heart he does not share these insane criminal desires. Let him hide these pursued victims, help them to get over their borders, and do what he can to save them from the Nazi hangman." Roosevelt promised that as military operations permit, the United States would find havens of refuge for all intended victims of the Nazi and Jap executioner. After hearing him read the proclamation, reporters had only one question. They asked, "Did the president plan to bring any refugees to the United States?" "No, not yet," he said, "because there aren't enough to come." As Morgenthau fought to help refugees, he butted heads with John McCloy. McCloy agreed with Stimson that U.S. armed forces should not be used to rescue the victims of the Nazis unless doing so was the direct result of military operations intended to win the war. Like Stimson, McCloy insisted that the best way to help the Jews and other victims of Hitler was simply to win the war as quickly as possible. In the late spring of 1944, Morgenthau pressed the War Refugee Board to find an unused army base or some other haven in the United States where a small group of mostly Jewish refugees from Italy could be housed temporarily. On Tuesday, June 1, when one of Morgenthau's aides raised the matter with McCloy by telephone, McCloy said it wasn't the army's business to take care of refugees. Morgenthau was outraged by McCloy's reaction. That afternoon, he took a record of the conversation to a cabinet meeting and gave it to Roosevelt, Hull, and Stimson to read. Stimson was annoyed that McCloy had not briefed him about the refugees, but he frankly told the president he agreed with McCloy that refugees were no business of the War Department. But Roosevelt replied that under no circumstances must these people be turned back. After the meeting, Stimson dictated a memo saying that someone at cabinet, referring to Morgenthau, had criticized McCloy as an oppressor of the Jews. When McCloy read the document, he was furious. Learning of McCloy's anger, Morgenthau asked him to come the next morning to his house to clear the air. McCloy arrived 10 minutes early. He told Morgenthau, "I understand that I was criticized at cabinet." Several times he told Morgenthau, "Somebody in cabinet said that I was the oppressor of the Jews. That is a terrible thing." Morgenthau did not directly confess that he had made the comment, but he said, "That is why I wanted to send for you and want to get you straight." He explained that he had complained to Roosevelt and Stimson about McCloy's foot dragging on the refugees from Italy. Morgenthau was happy to exploit McCloy's discomfort to get him to turn up a dormant army base for the refugees. McCloy was abashed. He told him that Fort Ontario in Oswego, New York, could take 1,800 refugees. In Budapest, in defiance of Roosevelt's warning, the new regime was starting to wage war against the Jews of Hungary. By early June 1944, the Nazis had deported over a third of Hungary's Jews in only 3 weeks. Jewish leaders wrote to Morgenthau, the War Department, the War Refugee Board, and other American and British officials, imploring them to bomb the railway lines from Hungary to the death camp at Auschwitz in Poland. Operating under Churchill's instructions, British Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden wondered whether the murder factory itself should not be bombed. Churchill said, "Get everything out of the Air Force you can and invoke me if necessary." He told Eden, "There is no doubt that this is probably the greatest and most horrible crime ever committed in the whole history of the world, and it has been done by scientific machinery, by nominally civilized men, in the name of a great state and one of the leading races in Europe." On June 24, as director of the War Refugee Board, John Paley cautiously asked McCloy to explore the matter. McCloy saw the proposal as a clear violation of his and Stimson's dictum that military resources be used only for winning the war. On July 4, 1944, he wrote Paley that bombing the railway lines would be of doubtful efficacy and could be executed only by the diversion of considerable air support essential to the success of our forces now engaged in decisive operations in Europe. Later, McClaw used almost the same language to veto requests to bomb Auschwitz itself. As the historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. has rightly argued, Franklin Roosevelt, more than any person, deserves the credit for mobilizing the forces that destroyed Nazi barbarism. Still, a half century later, one of the most controversial aspects of Roosevelt's World War II leadership is the American failure to bomb Auschwitz. Roosevelt's largest defenders concur with McCloy's view that diverting bombers and crews from the bombing of German industry and other strategic targets might have postponed VE Day, and that if that had happened, it might have cost more Jewish lives than might have been saved by bombing Auschwitz. In contrast, Elie Wiesel, that most eloquent survivor of the death camp known as Auschwitz III, wishes the Americans had bombed. Wiesel has written that even had the bombing killed the Jewish inmates, we were no longer afraid of death, at any rate, not of that death. Now, with more than a half century of hindsight, it is much clearer than it was in 1944 that the sound of bombs exploding at Auschwitz would have been a moral statement for all time. It would have said to future generations that the British and Americans understood the historical gravity of the Holocaust. In the face of so monumental a crime, it is hard to accept that the doctrine of the War Department on using military resources should have so rigidly prevailed. Much of the later indignation at the American failure to bomb Auschwitz has centered on John McCloy. Thanks to new information, however, we can conclude that the man who ultimately refused to bomb Auschwitz may not have been John McCloy, but Franklin Roosevelt. In New York City in 1986, 3 years before his death, McCloy had an exchange with Henry Morgenthau's son, Henry III, who is researching a family history, and taped their conversation. McCloy recalled that when Jewish leaders wanted me to order the bombing of Auschwitz, he took the matter to Roosevelt, who was irate at the suggestion. McCloy said that the president made it very clear to him that bombing Auschwitz wouldn't have done any good, and that we would have been accused of destroying Auschwitz by bombing innocent people. By McCloy's account, Roosevelt said, "Why the idea? They'll say we bomb these people, and they'll only move it down the road a little way, and we'll bomb them all the more." Roosevelt said, "We'll be accused of participating in this horrible business." If McCloy's confession to Henry Morgenthau III can be believed, it might not be wholly a coincidence that the one person to whom McCloy finally revealed that he was not the one who ultimately vetoed bombing Auschwitz was the son of the man who in 1944 called McCloy an oppressor of the Jews. On Thursday, July 6, 2 days after McCloy wrote Paley refusing to bomb Auschwitz, Morgenthau went to the White House. During a meeting with the president on occupied France, he asked whether it would be all right for me to go to France to see how U.S. occupation currency was getting along. The president said that would be fine. Morgenthau insisted years later that his only purpose was to study currency problems in France, but he doubtless had other motives. He was exhilarated by the idea of visiting the Allied battlefront, as he had once done in North Africa. He may also have hoped to use the trip to help win himself a major role in shaping the European peace, especially the fate of Germany, about which his emotions were now running at high fever. Morgenthau wanted to stop in London, where he intended to see if more could not be done to rescue Jews. By the first week of July 1944, almost 500,000 Jews had already been deported from Hungary to the Nazi death camps.
We will have to get awfully busy.
With a fighter escort, Morgenthau's plane roared from New York City into the night over the Atlantic. During the 22-hour flight, Harry Dexter White, the Treasury's chief international economist, pulled out a memo from the State Department on property rights in post-war Germany that he knew would provoke his boss. Morgenthau read the document with rising anger. It said that Germans would need to support themselves after the war. It said that Germany must promote the revival of Europe and provide manufactured goods to its victims. As a result, the Allied victors, it said, must shore up most of Germany's industrial apparatus. To Morgenthau, the paper ignored the most basic question of all, which was, how do you keep Germany from ever again menacing the world? Just after midnight on Monday, August 7, 1944, Morgenthau and his party landed in Scotland. They were met by Colonel Bernard Bernstein of General Eisenhower's staff, who ushered them aboard the Supreme Commander's luxurious special train bound for Eisenhower's headquarters in Portsmouth. Bernstein was the financial advisor to Eisenhower's command, but earlier he had been a lawyer in Morgenthau's treasury. He revered his old boss and still thought of himself as a treasury man. Bernstein showed his old chief a draft Handbook for Military Government in Germany. It had been written for use once U.S. troops crossed the German border. Written by the German country unit of Eisenhower's headquarters, but not yet approved, the purpose of the handbook was to minimize the chaos as Anglo-American forces advanced through Germany. It said that conquering soldiers should be told that their main and immediate task was to ensure that the machine in Germany works efficiently. The soldiers should restore as quickly as possible the functioning of the German civilian government in the area for which you are responsible. German industry must be buttressed to support the Germans and keep Europe on an even keel. Every German must be promised 2,000 calories of food per day. Morgenthau was disgusted. In Portsmouth, he lunched with Eisenhower in the general's mess tent, along with his aides Fred Smith and Harry Dexter White. At Morgenthau's cue, White raised the subject to post-war Germany. Grimly, Eisenhower said, "I am not interested in the German economy, and personally I would not like to bolster it if that is going to make it easier for the Germans." As far as he was concerned, he said, German military leaders should be utterly eliminated, and Nazi ringleaders given the death penalty. Eisenhower went on to say that the German people, by supporting Hitler, had been accomplices to everything done in their name. They must not be allowed to escape a sense of guilt, of complicity in the tragedy that has engulfed the world. Eisenhower said, "The Germans have been taught to be paranoid in their actions and thoughts, and they have to be snapped out of it. The only way to do that is to be good and hard on them." Descended from 18th-century Rhineland Germans, Eisenhower later wrote in his memoirs that as the months of conflict wore on, I grew constantly more bitter against the Germans. To his wife Mamie, he wrote, "The German is a beast, and God, I hate the Germans." Since D-Day, the Germans had killed 16,000 and wounded 78,000 of Eisenhower's American boys. The very morning of Morgenthau's arrival, Eisenhower had heard a ghastly account of the Nazi death camps. Eisenhower had another reason to sound tough on Germany in Morgenthau's presence. He knew that in 1942, Morgenthau had been his severest critic in the cabinet when Eisenhower made his pragmatic deal with the Vichy French Admiral Jean Darlan. To blunt French opposition to the Allied invasion of North Africa, Eisenhower and the Allies had agreed to tolerate local Vichy decrees, including sanctions against the Jews. This time, the Supreme Commander was not going to give Morgenthau a second chance to imply that he was soft on the Nazis. Morgenthau was exhilarated that the much-admired Eisenhower seemed to share his views on post-war Germany. On his visit to occupied France, Morgenthau had an emotional reunion with his oldest son, Henry III, who was serving in General George Patton's Third Army. While touring Omaha and Utah beaches, the secretary accepted the gift of a captured German helmet. During his visit, Nazi propagandists were at work. Berlin radio let the German people know that while touring France, supposedly the Jew Morgenthau had stolen a priceless French tapestry. Flown back to England on Thursday, August 10, Morgenthau called on Churchill. He noted in his diary that Churchill seemed very glad to see me. Churchill had good reason to try to make Morgenthau happy. He was eager to continue receiving U.S. lend-lease aid during the period from the German surrender through the defeat of Japan. With Morgenthau, Churchill used the same combination of scare tactics and charm that he used on Franklin Roosevelt. Melodramatically, he told his American visitor that England's prospects were now very, very dark. He said the country was completely bankrupt and there was no future for the returning British soldier. Now Morgenthau asked Churchill whether Britain would join the United States in finding havens of refuge for the Jews of Hungary. Churchill said yes, but said that Palestine could not be one of them. He said he had promised the Arabs that as long as the war was on, he would not exceed the agreed-upon quota for Jews there. On Saturday, August 12, 1944, Morgenthau sat on the wide green lawn at Red Rice with Harry Dexter White, other aides, and Roosevelt's ambassador to London, John Wynat. He reported that Eisenhower had told him that we must take a tough line with Germany. Morgenthau said that he himself felt that the conquered state could be reduced to a land of small farms, like Denmark, where farmers close to the land were unaggressive and peace-loving. Morgenthau felt that the Jefferson agrarian philosophy that he considered himself to share with Roosevelt could purge the German spirit. Wynat did not buy it. He said, "Farmers make good fighters." On Sunday afternoon, August 13, Morgenthau took Wynat and White to Anthony Eden's house, where they had tea on the lawn. He told the British Foreign Secretary that he had gathered from Churchill that at least for the early months after victory, Germany would be forced to fend for itself. Eden responded that at the Tehran Conference, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin had agreed to dismember the country. Eden did not know that to keep the strings in his own hands, Roosevelt had refused to confide the substance of the Big Three's private conversations at Tehran to Morgenthau or other high American officials. But now the cat was out of the bag. Morgenthau quickly asked Eden to show him the British records of the secret Tehran talks on Germany before he left London. Desperate for Morgenthau's help on Lend-Lease, Eden was hardly in a position to say no. On Tuesday, Morgenthau and White went to Eden's office at Whitehall. As the American visitors listened with fascination, the Foreign Secretary read aloud from the records of Tehran in which the Big Three had spoken of dividing Germany and Roosevelt had insisted that the vanquished country be split into three or more parts. Morgenthau told Eden that if the Allied intention was to divide post-war Germany, then American officials who had been talking about reviving the German system were violating official policy. After midnight in London, Morgenthau gave an address on CBS radio to the American people. Roosevelt speechwriter Robert Sherwood and the CBS London correspondent Edward R. Murrow had helped to write it. Morgenthau told his audience that while touring the fallout shelters, the principal thought that filled my mind and heart had been, "We must never forget." He said it was not enough to hope that post-war Germans and Japanese would behave themselves as decent people. Hoping, he said, is not good enough. Germany and Japan must be kept disarmed. On Thursday, August 17, having returned to Washington, Morgenthau had lunch with his staff. In contrast to the top echelon of the State and War Departments, Morgenthau's staff was heavy with liberal reformist New Dealers who were indignant at the idea of German economic revival. Morgenthau told his aides that during his European trip, "I spent most of my time on how they're going to treat Germany." He said, "We're going to have to get awfully busy." Morgenthau warned them that their old bureaucratic adversaries seemed to be defying Roosevelt's intentions. He said, "It took me days and days and days, but I got the story." He said Hull's boys at State were the worst. They were saying, "Keep a central Germany, keep a strong Germany." Morgenthau concluded, "I don't know how much Mr. Hull knows, but he is certainly going to get an earful." On Friday morning, Morgenthau went to Cordell Hull's large office in the gray French Renaissance edifice next to the White House that housed the State Department. He told the Secretary of State that from all appearances, the Germans were supposed to be built up after World War II so that in 10 years they would be ready to wage a third world war. He said that Eden had read aloud to him from the minutes of Tehran, which showed that the Big Three had decided to divide Germany into 3 or 15 parts. Hull gasped. He said, "Henry, this is the first time I've ever heard this. I have never been permitted to see the minutes of the Tehran conference." Morgenthau was amazed. He knew that Roosevelt had circumvented his Secretary of State, but he had not realized it was this bad. He asked Hull where he stood on post-war Germany. The frail old Tennessean wistfully recalled the single excursion into urgent Allied diplomacy that Roosevelt had allowed him, the Moscow meeting with Eden and Molotov. Hull told Morgenthau, "The reason I got along so well with the Russians was because I said I would hold a secret trial of Hitler and his gang and shoot them all. Then I would let the world know about it a couple of days later. That's my position." Back at the Treasury, Morgenthau told his aides of the scene in Hull's office and said, "We will see what happens when I see the president."
Not nearly as bad as sending them to gas chambers.
On Friday, August 18, 1944, after his inspection tour of military installations in California, Hawaii, Alaska, and the Pacific Northwest, Franklin Roosevelt spent his first day at the White House in more than a month. Under Andrew Jackson's magnolia tree on the South Grounds, wearing a polka-dotted bow tie and shirt sleeves, Roosevelt lunched with his new Democratic running mate, Senator Harry Truman of Missouri. Truman thanked him, he said, for putting the finger on me for vice president. Truman had not seen Roosevelt for a year and was shocked by how much he had aged. A few weeks later, while coming out of the White House, an old Army friend told Truman to turn around and take a look because he would be living there before long. Truman said, "I'm afraid I am, and it scares the hell out of me." By the summer of 1944, a New York cardiologist named Howard Bruin had quietly been added to the president's entourage, examining him 3 or 4 mornings a week. Bruin privately concluded that Roosevelt was in cardiac failure, with a grossly enlarged heart and tortuous aorta. By 1944, although the public did not know it, Roosevelt was engaged in intense public business no more than 2 to 4 hours a day. About the severity of Roosevelt's condition, the public was told nothing. Roosevelt's declining condition eroded his ability to operate more than it might have done to other presidents. Roosevelt's approach to leadership was to play cabinet members off against one another, hold a dozen conflicting ideas in his head at any one time, and to keep the mechanics of control always firmly in his grasp. But with his energy and concentration ebbing, he no longer had the patience and command of detail that had once let him keep important policies from going off the rails and keep cabinet members confined to the roles he saw for them. On Saturday morning, August 19, Henry Morgenthau arrived at the White House. He was told that the president was running late and could only give him 5 minutes, but that they could talk on the train to Hyde Park that evening. Reporting on his trip, Morgenthau said that Churchill had confided to him that England was broke. Roosevelt scoffed. He said that Churchill was only trying to sweeten his chances to get more American lend-lease aid. Then Morgenthau told about his trip to Europe. He told of how little by little I put pieces together to find that planning for post-war Germany was in disarray. As Morgenthau told his diary, "The president didn't like it, but he didn't say anything. He looked very embarrassed, and I repeated it so that he would be sure to get it." Roosevelt was probably angry at Eden for divulging the information to Morgenthau, but he was doubtless especially piqued at his Hudson Valley friend for sticking his fingers where they did not belong, and most of all for Morgenthau pressing him to commit himself on post-war Germany before he wanted to. Roosevelt tried to signal Morgenthau that since they agreed completely, he should now butt out and let the president handle it. Roosevelt said. Give me 30 minutes with Churchill and I can correct this. We have got to be tough with the German people, not just the Nazis. You either have to castrate the German people, or you've got to treat them in such a manner so they can't just go on reproducing people who want to continue the way they have in the past. Why not be tough with Germany, he said. They have been tough with us. Morgenthau later told his diary that Roosevelt left no doubt in my mind whatsoever that he personally wants to be tough with the Germans. He and I are looking at this thing in the same way. But without Morgenthau knowing it, Roosevelt took action to stop his friend's freelancing. He asked his aide, Harry Hopkins, to ask Henry Stimson to have a talk with Morgenthau. Born in 1867, Henry Louis Stimson was descended from what he called sturdy middle-class people, religious, thrifty, energetic, and long-lived. With his thin gray-white mustache, his stiff public demeanor, and ancient suits, the 76-year-old Secretary of War seemed like a 19th-century outlander in Roosevelt's entourage. Appointed in 1929 as Herbert Hoover's Secretary of State, Stimson dealt with the subject of German reparations. He saw how the dead weight of reparations swelled German inflation, unemployment, and depression. Still, as his biographer Godfrey Hodgson wrote, Stimson's probity and rationality, his conventional mind, kept him from grasping the enormity of the disaster impending in Germany with the rise of Adolf Hitler. Stimson was the only figure in Roosevelt's circle, save General George Marshall, with whom the president did not dare play too many games. With Stimson, Roosevelt knew the public price he would pay if Stimson ever resigned over principle. Stimson was privately appalled by Roosevelt's harum-scarum delight in pitting people against one another. He wrote in his diary that Roosevelt was the poorest administrator I have ever worked under. He is not a good chooser of men, and he does not know how to use them in coordination. When Stimson joined the cabinet in 1940, he and Morgenthau were natural allies in military preparedness. But by August 1944, Morgenthau had come to view Stimson as an obstacle on Jewish refugees and perhaps as one of the men who were flatly refusing to consider bombing Auschwitz. Now Stimson and Morgenthau took their lunch in the Secretary of War's huge new office in the just-built Pentagon. Turning to business, Morgenthau told Stimson how he had discovered from Eden that the Big Three had agreed to dismember Germany. Stimson replied that the conversation at Tehran may have been more informal than Morgenthau realized. Morgenthau mocked Roosevelt's insistence that he and Churchill could settle the problem in 30 minutes. He said, I don't think Churchill is going to worry about it, and the president hasn't time to think about it. Morgenthau proposed that he, Hull, and Stimson draw up a common proposal for Roosevelt on post-war Germany before he met Churchill again. Stimson agreed. He said that one solution might be to internationalize the industrial Ruhr and Saar, throwing the region under joint multi-power control. Morgenthau was intrigued, but he said that he favored removing all industry from the Germans and reducing them to an agricultural population of small landholders. Stimson replied, Germany was that kind of nation back in 1860, but then she had only 40 million people. You might have to take a lot of people out of Germany. Morgenthau replied, well, that is not nearly as bad as sending them to gas chambers.
Somebody's got to take the lead.
By now, Morgenthau was on a mission. On Friday morning, August 25, Morgenthau telephoned John McCloy at the Pentagon. He said, Henry talking. Now look, I just feel somebody's got to take the lead about let's be tough to the Germans. He told McCloy that when U.S. soldiers went into Germany, there should be a military rate of 20 German marks to the dollar. From Morgenthau's point of view, this would allow the soldiers to dominate the post-war Germans like miniature Goliaths, striking a keynote of toughness. McCloy replied that the British take a different view. Worried that pegging the mark so low would topple the German economy, the British were proposing 5 marks to the dollar. The State Department was suggesting 8. 15 minutes later, Morgenthau called on Roosevelt in the Oval Office. He told the president that in the British government, he had found two schools of thought on post-war Germany. Eden felt we must trust Russia for the peace of the world. But Churchill was asking, what are we going to have between the white snows of Russia and the white cliffs of Dover? Roosevelt said, that's very well put. I belong to the same school as Eden. Morgenthau handed the president a copy of the Handbook for Military Government that he had been shown on the way to England. He also showed him a collection of provocative excerpts from the handbook compiled by his staff. Roosevelt pooh-poohed the manual. He said it could be read as both hard or soft on Germany. But, he told Morgenthau, I would like to keep it and read it tonight, and then I will return it to you. Now Morgenthau widened his compass. He told the president, sometime when you have time, I would like to do a little daydreaming with you as to the next 4 years. We don't know exactly what Morgenthau meant, but if he was fishing for another government job, there were only two he would have wanted, Secretary of State or War, and he knew that for both there were likely to be openings soon. Hull and Stimson were both old men of bad health. Morgenthau would also be far more able to ensure that America was tough on post-war Germany in one of those two posts than from the Treasury. Roosevelt quickly scotched any ambitions Morgenthau had. He said, now look, Henry, you and I will gradually ease out of our present jobs and become country gentlemen. There is going to be an organization of the United Nations with which I expect to be associated, and you should go with me. Morgenthau was disappointed by Roosevelt's reply. He wrote in his diary, I couldn't help but flash through my mind to how a couple of years ago the president said, you and I will run this war together, and then it was Hopkins and himself and me out on my ear. But I certainly planted the seed with him, and he keeps associating myself with himself, which is very pleasant. I am certainly going to remind him from time to time. As for post-war Germany, Morgenthau wrote, I am going to continue to feed to the president's suggestions, but it is quite obvious that he wants to keep me very much in the background and wants to do it in his own way, as usual. That day over lunch, Stimson warned Roosevelt that American troops were about to enter Germany with no instructions on vital points. He said his own view was that Germany should not be dismembered, nor should German industry be destroyed. That could cause 30 million people to starve. Stimson told the president that if U.S. officers were to shoot high-ranking Nazis, it must be immediate, and they should have definite instructions on exactly who should be executed. At a cabinet meeting that afternoon, Roosevelt used Morgenthau's memo to complain about the Handbook for Military Government. He was especially repelled by the handbook's insistence that after the German surrender, the Allies restore as quickly as possible the regular German civil service and the highly centralized administrative system and import needed commodities to feed the Germans. Roosevelt told his cabinet that he had accepted Morgenthau's recommendation to appoint a cabinet committee on Germany. The members would be Hull, Stimson, and Morgenthau, with Harry Hopkins as coordinator. Morgenthau was euphoric that Roosevelt now seemed to share his revulsion against the Handbook for Military Government. He took the president's decision as a triumph for himself. That same afternoon, Roosevelt wrote what McCloy called a spanking letter to Stimson. Roosevelt wrote, "This so-called handbook is pretty bad. It gives me the impression that Germany is to be restored just as much as the Netherlands or Belgium. I do not want them to starve to death, but if they need food to keep body and soul together, they should be fed 3 times a day from army soup kitchens. They will remember that experience all their lives." The president went on to say he would not accept the view of those who said the German people as a whole are not responsible for what has taken place, that only a few Nazi leaders are. The Germans, he said, must have it driven home that they were a defeated nation, so that they would hesitate to start any new war. He said the Allies must make the Germans understand that their whole nation had been waging a lawless conspiracy against the decencies of modern civilization. Later that day, Stimson flew to Saranac, New York, for his August holiday at the Ossable Club. From his cottage there, Stimson regularly spoke by telephone to McCloy at the Pentagon. He warned McCloy that Morgenthau was trying to foment a very bitter atmosphere of personal resentment against the entire German people, leading to clumsy economic action as a weapon of mass vengeance.
Christianity and Kindness.
On Saturday, September 2, 1944, the President and First Lady motored from Hyde Park to have tea with the Morgenthaus at Fishkill Farms. Roosevelt and Morgenthau spent an entire hour talking about Germany. The President said he had written to Stimson and McCloy about the Handbook for Military Government, quoting directly from your memorandum, and he had certainly put them in their place. Morgenthau handed the President a draft he had just received of his staff's current suggestions on Germany, including a map. He said that it didn't go nearly far enough. Mischievously, Roosevelt said, I wonder if you have the three things that I am interested in. We will see as we go along. Roosevelt read Morgenthau's document, then he revealed his three demands. He said, Germany should be allowed no aircraft of any kind, not even a glider. Germans should not be allowed to wear military uniforms, nor should they be permitted to march. Roosevelt said, if you don't allow them to wear a uniform and there was no marching, that would do more to teach the Germans than anything else that they had been defeated. Morgenthau may have wondered whether Roosevelt was pulling his leg. Politely, he said, that's very interesting, Mr. President, but the heart of the German war machine is the Ruhr. If the Ruhr merely became an international zone, it is just time before Germany will attempt an Anschluss. By Anschluss, he meant an effort to take the region back. Morgenthau went on to say, instead they should dismantle the Ruhr's factories and give the machinery to countries that need it, even if that put 18 or 20 million Germans out of work. Roosevelt said he did not care how many Germans were put out of work. He said, just feed them out of American Army soup kitchens. Morgenthau told the President that the other big problem was the mentality of Germans between 20 and 40. They had been inculcated with Nazism. He said, you may have to transplant them out of Germany to some place in Central Africa where you can do some big TVA project. By TVA, Morgenthau was referring to Roosevelt's Tennessee Valley Authority, one of his biggest public works projects of the 1930s. Roosevelt told Morgenthau, you will have to create entirely new textbooks for the Germans. Then Morgenthau mentioned McCloy. Roosevelt played to his audience. He said, oh, the trouble with McCloy is he is just an appeaser. Morgenthau later told his diary that Roosevelt's comment about McCloy was very, very unfair. Despite their disagreements over Auschwitz and post-war Germany, Morgenthau felt that McCloy was amongst a half dozen civilians who had done the most to prosecute World War II. Then Morgenthau warned the President against Robert Murphy. Just appointed as Eisenhower's political aide on the Germans, Murphy had been mentioned as a possible U.S. military governor of Germany. Morgenthau complained to Roosevelt that as U.S. liaison in North Africa, Murphy had been living in the pocket of Admiral Jean Darlan. Before their conversation ended, Roosevelt told Morgenthau that he would raise his prescription for a harsh German peace when he met Churchill at Quebec. But he said, I don't know how far I will get with Churchill on this. Morgenthau said, I think Eden will go along with you. Roosevelt replied, it will be tough sledding with Churchill. Later that afternoon, the Morgenthaus drove to Mrs. Roosevelt's cottage, Valkill, in Hyde Park. Morgenthau asked the First Lady if he had been too aggressive with the President. She said no. Morgenthau told her he was convinced that the President wants to do the right thing about the Germans, but he hasn't got the time to look into it thoroughly, and everything that has been done so far is useless, so some of us have to do it for him. In his diary, Morgenthau recalled that Eleanor Roosevelt had been slightly pacifist before the war. He had feared that she might be too sentimental about post-war Germany. That was one of the main reasons, he wrote, why I went up to see her. I thought she might think we should go a little easy on the Germans, but she doesn't. Mrs. Roosevelt told Morgenthau she agreed with what he had told the President about Germany, But she said that she had been told that there were German prisoners of war with whom we can deal after surrender. The First Lady had recently been reading a widely publicized book by a New York psychiatrist named Richard Brickner called Is Germany Incurable? Boasting a jacket blurb from the anthropologist Margaret Mead, the book concluded that German society was paranoid and megalomaniac. Mrs. Roosevelt disagreed. She felt that one cannot treat a whole people that way. After her visit with Morgenthau, Mrs. Roosevelt wrote her young friend Joseph Lash that while Morgenthau seemed to think he knew the president's thinking on Germany, Franklin probably had not yet made up his mind. She observed that her husband usually kept his thoughts to himself, even from people like Henry, while he lets them all talk. On Monday, September 4, Morgenthau was back at the Treasury in Washington. Alluding to Roosevelt's mid-September meeting with Churchill scheduled for Quebec, Morgenthau warned his staff that they now had only a week to reach the president, if you get what I mean, before he has another important meeting, see? Morgenthau said that Roosevelt was entirely agreeable to closing down the Ruhr. He said, "Just strip it. I don't care what happens to the population. I would take every mine, every mill and factory and wreck it. Steel, coal, everything. Just close it down. Make the Ruhr look like some of the silver mines in Nevada." Morgenthau's Undersecretary Daniel Bell injected, "Sherman's march to the sea." Morgenthau corrected him, "No, some of those ghost towns. Make this a ghost area. If the region were stripped of its machinery and its mines flooded, dynamited, and wrecked," he said, "Germany would be impotent to wage more wars." Harry Dexter White warned Morgenthau that shutting down the Ruhr might exile millions of Germans and harm the rest of Europe. Morgenthau did not care. He recalled his father's World War I experience as Wilson's ambassador to Turkey. He said, "One morning the Turks woke up and said, 'We don't want a Greek in Turkey.' They moved 1 million people out. They said to the Greeks, 'You take care of them.' The people lived. They got rehabilitated in no time. It seems inhuman," he said, "it seems cruel, but we didn't ask for this war. We didn't put millions of people through gas chambers." He said the Germans had asked for it. He said, "For the future of my children and my grandchildren, I don't want those beasts to wage war. I am not going to be budged." Stimson wrote in his diary that by late afternoon I felt I had had a full day, but I had an engagement to dine with Morgenthau. So I went home and rested for an hour, and then went to dinner at his house. Morgenthau had also invited McCloy and Harry Dexter White. Of his evening with Morgenthau, Stimson told his diary, "Morgenthau is, not unnaturally, very bitter, and as he is not thoroughly trained in history or even economics, he would plunge out for a treatment of Germany which I feel sure would be unwise." Morgenthau's intentions for Germany reminded Stimson of the vindictive peace that Rome had imposed on Carthage. During their dinner, Stimson infuriated Morgenthau by saying, "I think we can't solve the German problem except through Christianity and kindness." The next morning, Tuesday, September 5, Hull, Stimson, Morgenthau, and Hopkins had their first formal session on Germany. Hopkins had told Morgenthau, "We will have to meet with Roosevelt quick before somebody else changes his mind." To Stimson's tremendous surprise, during the meeting, Hull sounded as bitter as Morgenthau against the Germans. Stimson was shocked that Hull was suddenly so ready to jettison all the free trade principles that for 12 years he had been working for. Once again, Hull recorded what a hit he felt he had made with the Russians in Moscow by saying he would have a drumhead court-martial and shoot many Nazis. Stimson crisply insisted, as he had the night before, that Germany be treated with Christianity and kindness. The Americans must follow some kind of legal procedure before people were shot. Stimson said it was very singular that he, the man in charge of the department that had done the killing in the war, was the only one who seemed to have any mercy for the other side. Stimson warned his colleagues that 30 million people will starve if the Ruhr is closed down. This is just fighting brutality with brutality. When the meeting broke up, as Stimson observed, they were irreconcilably divided. Hull said it was obvious that they would not be able to agree on a proposal on Germany to send to the president. He said, "If anybody has a plan, let him send it separately." That afternoon, McCloy called Hopkins to tell him that the morning meeting had made the Secretary of War depressed and angry. McCloy said if Roosevelt did not do something fast, he would be confronted with a majority recommendation for turning Germany into farmland that might be very hard for the president to veto. The next morning, Roosevelt called his Committee on Germany to the Cabinet Room at the White House. Stimson wrote in his diary, "After what happened yesterday, I was much alarmed about this meeting and expected to be steamrolled by the whole bunch." Gazing at Stimson, Roosevelt repeated his insistence that Germans could live from soup kitchens. He said, "Our ancestors lived successfully and happily without many luxuries. For example, in Dutchess County in 1810, people had worn homespun wools." He said, "As a boy, he had used a Chicksale outhouse. People could get along without bathrooms and still be perfectly happy." Impatient with Roosevelt's chatter, of which he had heard more than he wished during 4 years as Secretary of War, Stimson reminded Roosevelt that the issue was Morgenthau's plan to make an ash heap out of the Ruhr. Stimson said that unless the German economy were quickly revived, there would be a dangerous convulsion in Europe. "They must not burn down the house of the world just to get a meal of roast pig," he said. To Morgenthau's shock, Roosevelt now agreed with Stimson. He said there was no particular hurry to decide right away on the Ruhr. They could leave the German steel mills intact and then act in 6 months or a year. He reminded Hull that they had both long worked for free trade, and "we have got to do just that in Germany." Roosevelt said, "Britain is going to be in sore straits after the war. Perhaps the Ruhr could furnish raw material for British steel companies." Morgenthau could not believe what he was hearing. He was deeply upset. The next morning, the president called him to the Oval Office for some stroking. Trying to smooth over their differences, Roosevelt told Morgenthau that the whole question seemed to be about closing down the plants in the Ruhr, and we've got to do the thing gradually. But Morgenthau knew that if the Ruhr were not closed down almost immediately after the German surrender, it almost certainly would never be. He left the White House dejected and tense. At the Pentagon, Stimson was complaining to General George Marshall about Morgenthau's eagerness to shoot Nazi war criminals without trial. He said he was not a bit surprised by what he had heard, but "I was appalled, a different thing." Marshall told Stimson, "It's the same sort of thing that happens after every war, and the bitterness after this one is sure to be extreme." Stimson later wrote in his diary, "It was very interesting to find that Army officers have a better respect for the law in those matters than civilians who talk about them and who are anxious to go ahead and chop everybody's head off without trial or hearing." At Morgenthau's request, Roosevelt called a new meeting of the Cabinet Committee on Germany. After McCloy heard that that meeting was coming, he warned Stimson that Morgenthau still sticks to his guns and was using the entire forces of the Treasury to demolish Stimson's position on Germany. Stimson wrote in his diary, "So we are in for some fireworks."
It is very, very necessary.
To collect his resources for the coming battle, Stimson invited his friend Justice Felix Frankfurter to dine with him. When Stimson brought up the subject of post-war Germany, he was relieved to find, as he wrote, that although a Jew like Morgenthau, Frankfurter was approaching the subject with perfect detachment and great helpfulness. Frankfurter dismissed Morgenthau as a stupid bootlick who did not deserve his high post. As Stimson described Morgenthau's designs on the Ruhr and punishing the Nazis, Frankfurter snorted with astonishment and disdain. He emphatically agreed with Stimson that we must give these men the substance of a fair trial and that they cannot be railroaded to their death. The justice added that most of these Nazi crimes have not been directed at the American government or the American army, but at the people and armies of our allies. On Saturday morning, September 9, came the next meeting of the Cabinet Committee on Germany. Morgenthau brought in black loose-leaf-bound copies of his final plan for post-war Germany. larded with charts, maps, and graphs. The report's formal title was Program to Prevent Germany from Starting a World War III. But from this moment on, it would always be known as the Morgenthau Plan. Under the Morgenthau Plan, all German heavy industry would be destroyed. The Ruhr and nearby areas would be internationalized and not again be allowed to become an industrial area. All Germans in the Ruhr with industrial training or skills would be encouraged to leave the country forever. German plants and equipment, German labor, and other assets would be given to the Soviet Union and other nations that were Germany's victims. After the war, there would be no reparations in the form of recurrent payments or goods. That would require the German economy to be rebuilt and ultimately give Germany a larger share of foreign markets than in the 1930s. According to the Morgenthau Plan, the Allied Army's only involvement in the German economy after surrender should be to aid the Allies' military operations. Feeding, housing, and clothing the Germans should be the burden of the German people. Morgenthau was still ignorant of Roosevelt's private instructions on precisely how Germany should be divided in Allied occupation zones, so he had ordered his staff to propose how Germany should be permanently dismembered. Under the Morgenthau Plan, East Prussia would be divided between the Soviet Union and Poland. France would get the Saar and nearby lands. A northern German state would be organized around the old Prussia, Saxony, and Thuringia. A southern state would include Bavaria, Württemberg, and Baden. All German schools, universities, radio stations, and periodicals would be shut down until the Allies restructured them. According to the Morgenthau Plan, in deference to Roosevelt's wishes, all German aircraft, military uniforms, bands, and parades would be banned. Morgenthau wanted the Allies to draw up a list of arch-criminals of the war. These villains would be apprehended as soon as possible and put to death immediately by firing squads. Sharing Roosevelt's dark views about German national character, Morgenthau's plan said, "The Nazi regime is essentially the culmination of the unchanging German drive toward aggression. Therefore, German militarism cannot be destroyed by destroying Nazism alone." Before leaving for this meeting, Morgenthau had thanked his staff. He said, "I am very glad we are doing what we are. I should think it will be very useful to the president at Quebec. Please don't stop. Please keep right on. It is very, very necessary." When Roosevelt met with the Cabinet Committee on Germany in the Cabinet Room at noon, he looked gray and exhausted. For days, he told friends, he had been feeling low and logy. The Secretary of the Treasury passed out copies of the Morgenthau Plan to his colleagues. Stimson later told his diary, "None of us had seen this until we got into the room, and therefore it was impossible to discuss it intelligently." From Morgenthau's briefing book, Roosevelt read one of the talking points aloud. He said, "It is a fallacy that Europe needs a strong industrial Germany." Roosevelt said this was the first time he had seen this stated. He said, "All the economists disagree, but I agree with that. Furthermore, I believe in an agricultural Germany." Stimson was outraged. He said, "An agricultural Germany would breed war, not peace. It would arouse sympathy for Germany all over the world." Stimson said he was unalterably opposed to Morgenthau's desire that German industry be substantially obliterated. Stimson also derided Morgenthau's eagerness to put so-called arch-criminals to death without trial. He said, "Better to try the chief Nazi officials with an international tribunal." Stimson also objected to any permanent partition of Germany. Roosevelt said, "I think there will be two things brought up with Churchill at Quebec. One is military and the other is monetary, because Churchill keeps on saying he is broke." Roosevelt added, referring to Morgenthau, "If the British bring up the financial question, I will want Henry to come to Quebec." Morgenthau was thrilled by what he heard. He felt that after moving inch by inch all week, as he told his diary, the president now seemed to be taking his side on Germany after all. Stimson was upset. He wrote in his diary that the cabinet committee meeting with Roosevelt had been very discouraging, and I came away rather low in my mind. That afternoon, Stimson took a military plane to Mitchell Field on Long Island. He was to have a weekend's rest at his country estate called Highhold. As the plane soared up the eastern seaboard, Stimson studied his black-bound copy of the Morgenthau Plan, which he called a new diatribe against the Nazis. In his diary, he said, "The Morgenthau Plan was full of the bitter spirit of Morgenthau's old paper, but now buttressed by alleged facts drawn up by the Treasury." Angrily, Stimson scrawled in the margins of the Morgenthau Plan such comments as, "Childish folly, a beautiful Nazi program, this is to laugh." Next to the section on how the Morgenthau Plan would benefit British trade, Stimson wrote, "Bribe to UK." From Highhold, Stimson spoke by telephone with Justice Frankfurter. Frankfurter told him to let the Morgenthau Plan fall to the wayside by its own weight. Frankfurter said, "The president will catch the errors and see that its spirit is all wrong."